parliamentarians, in line with the government and its defense of natural resources, approved this draft agreement that condemns the theft from the people, orchestrated by the most radical and submissive opposition, as well as by the United States government and its multiple attacks on the Bolivarian Republic.
From all instances, Venezuela stands resolute to maintain its independence and to preserve its resources. Those are the premises that are the cornerstone of the Bolivarian Revolution and the current policies by the government facing new forms of attacks. Gladys Quesada, Caracas, Venezuela.
الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
The following is part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with school and university students. The meeting took place in the Imam Khomeini Rahmatullah Alayhi Husseiniyah on November 3, 2025, on the eve of Student Day and the National Day of Fighting Global Arrogance.
The students weren't planning on staying inside the embassy. After they went inside the embassy, they discovered documents there showing that the matter was much graver than they had initially thought. This wasn't just about a resolution passed by the US Senate. The US Embassy was a center for conspiracy, plotting, and strategizing to sabotage the revolution. In other words, the US were busy conspiring to implement their plans. The embassy was no longer an embassy. Well, all embassies have centers of information. They gather information about the country where the embassy is located. They collect the data and send it to their own country. There is nothing wrong with that. This wasn't the case with the US embassy. The problem with the US embassy was that it was a place for conspiring against the revolution. They would meet people, provoke people, create organizations, use any remnants of dissatisfaction remaining from the former regime, and if possible, they would rally the army to take action against the revolution. The students understood this. When they realized this, they stayed in the embassy. Now, for one to question, why did they take over the embassy? And to say that our problem with the US arose from that point is an inaccurate statement in my view. First, our problem with the US didn't begin with the event that took place on the 13th of Aban, November 4th, 1979. It began on the 28th of Mordad, 1953. Nation's opposition to the US dates back to that time. Second, the 13th of Aban actually signified the discovery of a plot and a great danger to the revolution. The students discovered this, God bless them. They were able to gather the documents. With great difficulty, they pieced together the documents that had been put through the shredding machine and were able to realize what had been going on inside the embassy. The US couldn't tolerate the revolution. Because the revolution had ripped a sweet morsel right out of the US's throat, Iran had been an unparalleled prize that was in the possession of the US. Iran was entirely under the domination and power of the US. The US took Iran's oil, they plundered its underground resources, they seized its facilities and its money. They sold whatever goods they wanted to Iran at whatever price they pleased. This was what the situation had been like. And then this was taken away from the US.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Turkish Radio.
What's going on, everyone? Ali Reza here, back with a brand new episode of Iran Tech. And in this week's episode, we're going to be focusing on what is going on in the bleeding edge of the world of oral and maxillofacial surgeries and the role that prosthetics and implants, more specifically, 3D printed custom patient-specific prosthetics are playing in that realm while being assisted by an actual professional oral and maxillofacial surgeon who's also a university professor. So stay tuned as we get started. Over a few scenarios in which a maxillofacial surgery would be necessary. We, of course, have congenital defects, defects and malformities in the facial bone structure that may happen at birth. Some parts of the skull may just be entirely missing, which would need to be replaced with an implant, because there's very little you can do with the bone outside of replacing it or taking it out entirely and, again, replacing it with a prosthetic. Then, of course, we have traumatic injuries, injuries that may be caused as a result of an accident, some workplace incidents, or maybe two people just having a fight. A motorbike rider could hit his chin on the ground and break his jaw. And again, you can't do very much with that jaw. You can't really repair it. You must essentially replace it with something like a prosthetic, which we're going to get to. Then, of course, we have certain infections and pathological diseases that could cause erosion in the facial bone structure. We even saw some cases in the post-COVID era, or rather post-patients getting COVID era, where certain infections, certain types of fungi would grow in this area and would cause erosion in the facial bone structure. We have cancer tumors, which are a primary suspect for maxillofacial surgeries. Cancer tumors can completely erode a certain parts of the skull by the cancer tumors growing and replacing those healthy cells. And again, you have to just take out those and the entirety of that cancer tumor and replace it with something. So this is where custom-made 3D-printed prosthetics come into play, because we have traditionally been treating these conditions by using off-the-shelf parts most of the time. This is not a new surgical procedure. It's just that now that the modern thing about it is the replacement of off-the-shelf parts with custom-printed, patient-specific parts that can even replicate the contour of the jaw without too much grinding to make the off-the-shelf part fit the facial structure, the bone structure of the specific patient. So now, let's listen to Dr. Bayot, who's a surgeon performing maxillofacial surgeries on a daily basis. Tell us more about these conditions, and also where Iran is with regards to the bleeding edge of what is going on in the science of maxillofacial surgeries.
We required the fabrication of a custom prosthesis for the patient, which necessitates specific software filters and resources, all of which are now available within Iran's domestic capabilities. This includes a specialized software for virtual design and reconstruction, as well as a trained workforce proficient in using these tools developed through local university research centers. The process relies on advanced 3D printing technology with printers manufactured domestically. For practical models, FDM or resin-based printers are used, while the final medical-grade implants are produced through laser sintering of titanium powder, a technique that ensures biocompatibility. Each prosthesis undergoes rigorous post-processing involving physical and chemical treatments before it is approved for surgery. Furthermore, Iran has developed the capacity to produce patient-specific implants through local knowledge-based companies. The quality of these domestically produced implants matches or exceeds international standards in certain aspects. We are committed to expanding these capabilities and continue to integrate digital surgical guides and 3D printing technologies into standard implant procedures, consistently delivering advanced medical solutions to patients.
Now let's take a closer look at one of these actual implants. There's not too many of them available here because each one of them that is built for a specific procedure, and they're used and they're probably in the patient's face right now, but there are a couple available. So they're made of titanium. They're all custom 3D printed to be patient specific, and they're used in a variety of different oral and maxillofacial surgical procedures. So this one is a mandibular implant. Let's take a look at a couple of the other examples that are used. Let's take a look at a specific model that is used for an orthognathic procedure, which involves cutting the jaw and realigning it for your teeth to align perfectly fine. So this one, you can see that there's a cutting guide for the surgeon, and you may assume that you can just cut anywhere around the jaw to be able to realign it, but no. The cut has to be optimal so as to minimize the potential damage to the patient. Maybe there's a root canal underneath this cut that needs to be avoided. So there is an optimal cut, and using this guide, the surgeon can optimally cut the jaw to be able to realign it. Now, of course, for the realignment itself, there are a couple of other guides which will be used to measure where exactly the jaw needs to be, because these two pieces, which are going to be mounted onto the teeth, how these two pieces are going to align together. This will tell the surgeon where exactly he needs to fit and fix the new jaw alignments. And that fixing is going to be done using these custom plates. There's going to be screws to hold the new place where the jaw is in place. There's, of course, other types of implants that are used with the same procedure. We have the superior stall implants, which are used for patients that cannot take teeth implants like a normal patient. So maybe the bone structure is too weak and cannot hold a tooth. So for them, these superior stall implants are going to provide a placeholder for the tooth implants. And that's where the oral 3D scan, which we're going to be seeing in just a little bit, comes into play. So taking a look at the manufacturing process, there's a couple of prerequisites that need to be checked before we start manufacturing this custom implant, and that is the combination of the 3D imaging capabilities of a CAT scan with this oral 3D scanner. This is not emitting any kind of x-rays or anything like that. It's just like a regular camera that is right here, and it's using a mirror to be able to image the inside of the mouth, and particularly the alignment of the tooth and the gums, because once these implants are made, there are certain holes that need to be put in the implants to very accurately tell the surgeon where the implant tooth is going to be added, because those holes are where the implant's teeth are going to be filled in with. So with that said, now that you've seen this imaging system, of course you're going to see some CAT scans too. Now let's take a closer look at the manufacturing process after the imaging system has been gone through.
Titanium implants have proven so far to be the best type of implant when an implant is necessary in facial reconstruction or cosmetic surgeries. This is due to their strength, biocompatibility, and ability to integrate with bone, or osseointegration. However, like any medical procedure, there can be potential complications or issues associated with titanium implants in the face, but they're not 100% free of risks or complications. The biggest inconvenience is that metal is more sensitive to temperature changes, particularly in cold weather, when you may feel that the implant has gotten way colder than the rest of your body temperature, and you would feel it. Over long periods, the implant may also move a bit and cause asymmetry, as rare as it may be, or put a bit too much pressure on the bones around it, can cause deformation. As rare as both these cases may be, there must be a better way to go about these procedures. What if there was a material that could gradually degrade over time and be replaced by your actual bones? That means it can be metal, with all desirable and not-so-desirable properties that it brings. This is where we delve into the uncharted territory of bioimplants.
In one of the cases where we used these technologies, the patient had a benign mandibular tumor that needed to be removed. First, we performed a surgery virtually in a virtual space and created the surgical guide. We built the guide for the specific location where the pathological bone needed to be cut. We went into the operating room, installed the guide on the patient's jaw, and made the cut exactly where the bone was to be removed. After this stage, we fixed a custom-made patient's specific plate onto the remaining part of the jaw. Because it had been completely pre-designed, even the holes used for the guide matched the holes for the screws on a final prosthetic plate. It fits into place with 100% accuracy, causing no cosmetic damage to the patient, and the contour and shape of the patient's face and jaw are completely preserved. Following this stage and the installation of the plate, using the scans we had previously taken of the patient's teeth, we 3D printed teeth that were identical to the patient's own and delivered them to the patient in the same session, right in the operating room. This means the patient enters the operating room with a tumor, undergoes surgery and reconstruction, including dental reconstruction. The patient comes in with their teeth and leaves the operating room fully reconstructed, with both bone and teeth restored. This is truly one of the most advanced procedures that can be performed using these technologies.
The implants that were explained, the titanium implants that are now being manufactured as customized and PSI, patient-specific implants, are the latest products currently being used in global markets for patients and have resolved many issues. However, the technology of implants, in terms of materials, is related to second-generation biomaterials, and now third- and fourth-generation materials are also entering the market. These are materials that are biodegradable, and after a certain period, the body decomposes them, allowing natural tissue to replace the materials. The fourth generation even involves the use of living cells or tissues to create materials. Technically, and in terms of using 3D bioprinting technology, we have achieved self-sufficiency in our country, thanks to God, and we are benefiting from the services provided by domestic knowledge-based companies.
The titanium implant that I showed you are considered second-generation implants, the first one being off-the-shelf parts that I mentioned. The third generation is the biodegradable implants that we just talked about. And fourth generation, which is by no means widely used yet, are biomimetic implants. They're still in the research phase, but they essentially involve the same biodegradable implant that we showed you with biomolecules, proteins, or drugs, or other cells that a medical professional may deem to be helpful or necessary for the integration of the implant within the facial structure, to be added within the perforation to create a biomimetic implant. Now, these biomimetic implants could help, like I said, a better, faster integration of the implants within the facial structure, but they are by no means yet financially, or rather commercially available yet. So if that actually starts to develop within this facility, we're definitely going to be coming back to check it out. And with that said, we've come to the end of this episode of Iran Tech. Thank you, guys.
WIB English Radio.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. The Hezbollah chief has slammed Israel's repeated ceasefire violations, saying that the regime seeks to lay the groundwork for Lebanon's gradual occupation and push for its Greater Israel project. The remarks come after a UN Security Council delegation met with Lebanese officials in Beirut to discuss the ceasefire and the almost daily Israeli aggressions. Press TV's Mariam Saleh looks into the issue.
Despite heightened U.S. and Israeli pressures on Lebanon, Hezbollah Secretary General Sheikh Naim Qassem says the resistance will not give up its only defensive capability. In a televised speech Friday, he emphasized that Hezbollah has no regard for U.S. and Israeli dictates.
We are cooperating with the government, which has taken the diplomatic route to end the aggression, and we are supporting it in its efforts. The U.S. and Israel have no business in dictating how we manage our internal affairs. Whatever we decide in Lebanon or what we do in Lebanon, whether on the issue of arms or other issues, does not concern them. The only framework which needs to be met in dealing with the Israeli enemy is the ceasefire agreement. We have complied, but Israel has not.
The Hezbollah chief said Israel's aggressions have nothing to do with Hezbollah's weapons. He said the regime seeks to lay the groundwork for the gradual occupation of Lebanon and push for its Greater Israel project. Sheikh Qassem warned that if Lebanon concedes, the U.S.-Israeli conditions will not be limited to the issue of arms. Experts believe that while the U.S. and Israel are jointly working on one agenda, they might differ on the means.
One area where they might disagree.
Well, joining us for tonight's edition of Spotlight, we have political analyst and international coordinator Charlotte Cates joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. And we also have activist and commentator Mick Napier, who's with us from Glasgow, UK. Welcome to the program. Let's start off with Ms. Cates. In Beirut, the Hezbollah chief has slammed Israel's repeated ceasefire violations and aggressions against Lebanon. Sheikh Naim Qassem says the attacks have nothing to do with Hezbollah's weapons, and rather the expansionist Israeli regime seeks to lay the groundwork for Lebanon's gradual occupation and to kickstart the so-called Greater Israel project through the Lebanese front. Please walk us through these key comments coming from Sheikh Naim Qassem.
Well, Sheikh Naim Qassem is, of course,
absolutely correct regarding what is currently taking place in Lebanon, the role of the United States and these forces that are attempting to pressure Lebanon, as well as certainly the ongoing Zionist attacks, which are taking place on a daily basis. It's been over a year since November 27th, 2024, since there was a ceasefire signed. Mm-hmm. And the result has been that there is a one-sided ceasefire in Lebanon. And nearly every day, the Zionists are engaging in bombing attacks, attempts to invade Lebanon. The fact is that the Zionist army was not able to seize a meter of land in South Lebanon during their overt and open invasion in 2024. It has only been during the ceasefire that they are able to continue out the same kinds of aggression. And the reason why they were prevented from actually advancing, other than by using their warplanes to sort of rain down destruction mm-hmm. upon the people of Lebanon, is because of the strength, power, and organization of the resistance. It's the resistance that prevented, if it weren't for Hezbollah and the Lebanese resistance, right now the south of Lebanon would be occupied by the Zionists and they would be rushing in to set up settlements. In fact, they were sending in, scholars to go study South Lebanon in order to make plans for settlements, and they were confronted by the resistance. This was during the open war between October and November of 2024. Right now, what we're seeing on a daily basis is there are attacks, very open attacks and assassinations of engineers, of home builders. One of the most frequent targets in South Lebanon are actually bulldozers and construction equipment, because the Zionists are attempting to prevent the people of South Lebanon from rebuilding from the damage that they caused, because they actually do want to settle and occupy the south of Lebanon. And every single one of these so-called U.S. conditions that the U.S. is attempting to impose upon Lebanon serves no other purpose except to weaken Lebanon and attempt to divide it in order to provide this quantitative advantage and qualitative advantage to the Zionist entity in the region.
Mick Napier, the Lebanese president, Joseph Aoun, he met with a delegation from the United Nations Security Council in Beirut. He urged the Security Council to pressure Israel to respect the ceasefire and to withdraw from Lebanon. We know that the UN has done nothing with regards to any of the Israeli violations in Lebanon, and also the daily massacres that we're seeing in Gaza. Both are in so-called ceasefires with the regime. How do you explain this inaction of the international community with the UN at its helm?
I mean, there was a time in the past, quite distant past, when the US and the UN would condemn Israeli aggression against Lebanon. I forget what year it was, in the 70s, when the Israelis attacked Beirut Airport and smashed up, destroyed pretty much the whole Lebanese civilian aircraft fleet. And they were condemned by the UN and I think even by the US. But those days, America simply ignored it. But those days are gone. And now I think, given that America is concerned much more about China than about anything in the Middle East, and for quite some long time has been talking about a pivot to Asia and actually reducing their forces in the area over the long term, I think they have put more eggs in the Israeli basket. And I think they are quite prepared to support Israel in everything it does, because they don't want to have American boots on the ground in the Middle East. So in a sense, the weakening of America in the area has led to them relying much more on the genocidal apartheid state to do the work for them. So Israel can get away with anything. It can get away with the mass genocide. It can get away with attacking Lebanon. It can get away with attacking Syria. And there are some voices in the U.S. at the moment, sorry, in Israel at the moment, who are talking about partitioning Syria, and that Israel will hold on to the ground which it occupied within the last few months. So there is no limit to the appetite of the Israelis for expansion. All that constrains them is their evaluation of the resistance which they will encounter if they try to do something. And they think at the moment, for example, that they can seize a part of Syria, either by insisting on the so-called demilitarization of an area, i.e. no oppositional military force allowed while their military takes over, or the actual seizure of it. They've already insisted that the Golan Heights is a part of Israel. They claim it's a part of Israel. And there's no reason why, if they have the ability, the Israelis will not try to expand
right.
across the Middle East. Moshe Dayan talked about an Israeli empire. Golda Meir, Ben Gurion, they always said the only limit to the Israeli to Israel is the ability to seize and hold ground. So I think that Charlotte's right. Only resistance can inhibit and slow down and prevent this and drive it backwards. But this is at a moment when America will give Israel the green light to do pretty much anything to weaken the states which surround it.
Charlotte Cates, about the greater Israel scheme, Benjamin Netanyahu and many other right-wing ministers have openly talked about this quote-unquote vision of a greater Israel, and they constantly brag about this expansionist project. What does this mean, not just for Palestinians, but for the entire region? And who are the main obstacles to an Israeli occupation spanning across West Asia?
I mean, just to be clear, the Zionist project has never been a project that is limited in time and space. It's always been, I mean, as Mick was describing, there is a tremendous appetite to carry out the project. The terminology that's been used to describe the Zionist project in Palestine has been that they're always trying to take more land and make sure there are fewer Arabs there. So constantly pushing out and engaging in ethnic cleansing, genocide, forced deportation and expulsion of the indigenous local population, and occupying and stealing land in order to settle it, in order to engage in a settler project, in order to exploit it, in order to exploit those who remain as labor, as a labor force, essentially, for the profit of the Zionist entity and its imperialist sponsors. And this has been part and parcel of the Zionist project from the beginning. It's not something that's new, and it's something that they've been supported in by Britain, the United States, and other imperialist powers, except to the extent that the U.S., for example, sees any value in maintaining its relationship or maintaining and propping up certain levels of client Arab regimes, Arab reactionary regimes, essentially as, partners to the United States, as states that are willing to host U.S. military bases directly and that engage in a very profitable economic relationship with the United States. So that's been the only kind of holdback, except for, of course, the forces of resistance in the region. And so, you know, despite the horrors, the absolute horrors of the ongoing genocide and the escalated genocide over the past 2 years in Gaza, at no point was the occupation ever able to fully occupy Gaza. Even now, when there have been a few isolated resistance fighters cut off from even the news of a ceasefire, they are still able to fight back in Rafah in the most unimaginable of conditions, cut off without food, without water, without even access to their comrades. And the same is true in Lebanon, the same is true in Iraq, the same is true in Iran, and of course the same is true in Yemen, where the Ansarullah movement, together with the armed forces and people of Yemen, reshaped the economy of the Red Sea and of Bab al-Mandab and of the Zionist ports. It's only the resistance forces that have been providing a strong bulwark against the expansionism of the Zionist state. And the partners in that project, or the people who have the capacity to be partners to the resistance project in the region, are certainly the popular movements around the world that have taken to the streets in force in order to stand with the Palestinian people against genocide, but also to stand with everyone in the region. This is also a time when some of these complicit and compliant Arab regimes, for example, in Egypt, really should start thinking clearly and recognizing clearly the threat that exists in the region, rather than continuing to play the game of acting on behalf of the U.S. and the Zionist entity.
Mick Napier, what's really mind-boggling here is the sheer hypocrisy in all of this. Let's say if, for example, in a hypothetical situation, Mexico had a greater Mexico plan with officials, Mexican officials, using a poster that had parts of Texas and California and Arizona included on its map. There would be outrage among Western governments.
Well, you see, where you see hypocrisy, I only see consistency. That if you are allied with America and Brussels and the UK and the whole imperium, you can pretty much do what you want. You can invade, you can seize, you can destroy, you can torture, you can take a political opponent and dissolve him in acid. And that will be okay for Mr. Trump and also for his predecessors. Anything goes. If you're not aligned with the empire, nothing goes. Anything you do, however benign, malign, positive, however humane, however committed to the welfare of your own people, anything you do will be seen as terrorism, as something horrible. Or if it can't be attacked, it will be ignored. Look, there is absolute consistency. If you're with America, anything goes. If you're against America, then you will always be the enemy. The mainstream media will fall into line, will demonize. There's always a new Hitler coming around the corner. And the new Hitler can be religious, can be secular. But if they oppose America and if they oppose Britain, then they are ready to assume the role of the so-called new Hitler. So, you know, yes, you use the word mind-boggling. The words cannot describe the difference between what is allowed to opponents, what is not allowed to opponents of the regime, and what is allowed once you align yourself with America. Dictatorship, extermination. Gaza is the petri dish. Gaza is a template for what is awaiting much of the rest of the world. And people know that. If anyone has any illusions of equality, if they want to say that brown-skinned people or black people are equal to white people, then trouble awaits them. This Jewish supremacist regime in Palestine, Israel, is also a white supremacist regime as well. And that is testing the ground, testing the weapons, testing the methods for dealing with future resistance to a world which could become much more like Gaza than anything else. So yes, you say mind-boggling, I understand that perfectly, but it falls into place and makes perfect sense when you realize that there is no morality, there's only the law of the jungle, and the only thing which matters in this world to the empire is the ability to resist. And we've seen this time after. Look, we're talking about Lebanon. Israel tried to seize the south of Lebanon before. Why were they driven out? By UN resolutions? Impossible. They were driven out by the resistance of the Lebanese people led by Hezbollah and other groups.
Right.
So only resistance can possibly defend the people across the whole Middle East from this monstrous expansionist regime.
Charlie Cates, I saw you nodding in agreement with what Mr. Napier was saying there. Talk to us about this evident hypocrisy, no condemnations from Western governments, and even the Western media sweeps it under the rug.
Well, I think it's beyond an issue of not condemning. For example, when we're talking about the United States in relationship to Lebanon, the U.S. is providing billions of dollars in weaponry on an annual basis to the Zionist regime. So when the Zionists are carrying out an assassination, a bombing, an attack on the south of Lebanon, when they're carrying out an assassination in a heavily populated area in the southern suburbs of Beirut, they're using U.S. weaponry and U.S. intelligence to carry out those attacks. So this isn't a situation where the U.S. is failing to condemn. This is a situation where the United States is jointly and severally liable for all of the war crimes being committed by the Zionist entity in Lebanon. And the same is true, even if it's at a slightly smaller scale at this point, for Britain, France, Germany, Italy, and all of the imperialist states that are full partners with the Zionist regime, and are, for that matter, even carrying out a, you know, pretty severe repression against their own population in order to prevent them from taking effective action in order to impose meaningful consequences on the Zionist entity. I mean, right now, there are six of the over 30 political prisoners in British jails who were on a hunger strike against the unjust persecution of activists organizing for Palestine and British ongoing complicity and support in the genocide, not just in Palestine, but in Lebanon and throughout the region. So when we're talking about the Western countries failing to condemn, it would be condemning themselves and their own actions. They're full partners of the Zionists in these attacks, particularly when we look at the visits of U.S. officials like Tom Barak and Morgan Ortagus to Lebanon. What they're trying to do, they're trying to call it sovereignty, but they're trying to actually take away any sovereignty that Lebanon retains. They want to impose U.S. financial conditions and the U.S. sanctions list upon Lebanon's domestic economy. They want to begin house-to-house searches in targeted regions of Lebanon at the behest of the United States and the Zionist entity. They want to essentially occupy the south of Lebanon and create a so-called buffer zone that would be an industrial zone for the exploitation of labor in the south of Lebanon, with the profits going to the U.S. and the Zionist entity. This is full-on complicity, and it's an attempt to terrorize the people and government of Lebanon into accepting normalization and submission. And Hezbollah and the resistance in Lebanon, aligned with the resistance forces in the region and around the world, are the number one force that is currently protecting every bit of sovereignty that Lebanon currently has.
Mick Napier, the so-called Greater Israel map, it includes Egypt, Jordan, Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, and in some illustrations, Saudi Arabia and even Kuwait. How is the silence and lack of proper action and outrage from other Arab countries further emboldened the Israelis in this regard? Who's to say that the Israeli regime won't come for more Arab land in the future?
Well, of course they will. They always have done. They were driven out of Lebanon by resistance after trying to seize and hold everything south of the Litani. They were driven out of Sinai by the heroism of Egyptian soldiers who fought them to a standstill in 1973. It was military force which achieved that. And only resistance will protect not just the Palestinians. The Palestinians' resistance will be discussed in military staff academies for a very long time to come. They've changed the rules of asymmetric warfare. They've achieved what no one thought 2 years ago was remotely possible. But the Palestinians are being massacred in huge numbers, and Israel is changing the balance in the Middle East at the behest of the USA or in alliance with the USA. Look, this is not just Palestinians versus Israelis. Charlotte's mentioned the full spectrum collusion and participation of imperial powers. The Royal Air Force, the British Air Force, flew over Gaza 500 times during the genocide of the last 2 years, supplying intelligence to the killers on the ground below. And the minister boasted about this in Parliament. 15% of the total parts of the F-35s, which are used to carry out the genocide in Gaza, come from Britain, and without British participation, those planes could not fly. So it's not, you're right, it's not support for the genocide we're talking about. The elected rector of Glasgow University, Palestinian, Hassan Abu Sitta, says we have to talk about an axis of genocide. I think it's a coalition of genocide: America, Britain, Brussels, and Israel. And Israel's obviously the spear point. But the genocide coalition is much, much wider than that. And I think it includes some of the Arab regimes as well. So look, in the long term, everything's working against the Israelis. The 7 million Zionist Jews surrounded by, 400 million, 450 million Arabs who can switch on the television and see Arabs being slaughtered because they are Arabs. This cannot persist for a very long time. But this dangerous beast, even as it faces its inevitable defeat, will cause incredible pain to the people across the Middle East. What we see in Gaza is the future that awaits people of Syria and Iraq and elsewhere, unless they follow the example of the Yemenis, of Hezbollah, and of other resistance forces across the region. They can see their doom in Gaza at the moment, and in the words of the Israelis,
okay,
that this is not the end.
And one last question for Ms. Cates. And on a broader issue here, what's so evident over the course of the last 2 years is the global awareness regarding the criminal nature of the Israeli regime. But when will governments and nation states start to reflect the will of the global public?
Well, it's certainly, in many cases, we do see some states that do reflect that. We see South Africa going to the International Court of Justice. We see support from states like Nicaragua, from Venezuela, who, of course, right now are also facing extreme war threats and illegal attacks and war crimes by the United States. But it's also our responsibility in the international movement to do everything that we can to escalate the struggle, to put real, meaningful pressure on the governments in order to force them into moderating or curtailing their complicity. And we've seen some success in Spain with this. We've seen some success in Ireland. But of course, this is like a limited level of success because it's really going to be, it's not going to be the same Western governments that are responsible for the crime that are going to bring it to an end.
Okay.
It's going to be our, yeah.
All right, that's all the time we have for tonight's show. Thanks to my guests, political analyst and international coordinator Charlotte Cates joining us from Beirut. Also thanks to activist and commentator Mick Napier joining us from Glasgow. And also special thanks to you, our viewers, for staying with us on tonight's edition of Spotlight. It's good night for now and see you next time.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.